On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Hi, this is Robert Sheeran. You're listening to Sheerintelligence, my podcast with KCRW, in which I speak with American originals who provide the intelligence. My guest today is Larry Gross, who is the director of USC's Annenberg School for Communication for over a decade and a professor at Penn for many years. He is also the author of several books, including Contested Closets, The Politics and Ethics of Outing. Larry Gross, welcome.
Great to be here.
I want to begin, and this is going to be sort of an open discussion about what has happened to gay people in America, and it's largely a positive story, yet, of course, we know from Orlando, the massacre. We also know here in Santa Monica, where we're broadcasting, someone was arrested with a lot of guns to presumably bring mayhem to the gay pride parade. But in the main, let's stick to the optimistic. I don't think any social protest movement has had as rapid a success. Very slow to start. One thing I've talked to Larry about in the past is that even in the 60s, which were proclaimed as a time of great change, for gay people it was not. Stonewall, one of the legendary incidents in the rise of gay people in America, happened after the 60s.
At the end of the 60s.
End of the 60s. Thank you, Larry. And a lot of it has to do with this word invisibility, up from invisibility, if you want to check out Larry's book. It's available. Your whole theme was basically as long as gays were invisible, they could be treated as an other in a virtual ghetto, another, you know, and the medical community declared this an illness, the legal community declared it a crime, the church declared it a sin, almost all churches. And what happened, and the reason for the rapid change, if I understand your work correctly, is that once gays came out of the closet, once they were no longer, an AIDS crisis obviously had a great deal to do with this, but, you know, ACT UP, a lot of protest movements and so forth. Once gays came out of the closet, it was discovered they were everywhere, in your family, your church, your co-workers, and you could not demonize or marginalize people who you actually had spent your life living with, but you didn't know were gay. Is that a fair summary?
Well, it's part of it. I think, interestingly enough, there are two, to some extent, opposite trends going on here, or two opposite things that happened since the middle of the 20th century in order for the changes that you referred to have taken place. The first is the emergence in the middle of the 20th century. I mean, quite explicitly, it can be dated to around 1950, the emergence of an identity as a minority group. Up until then, and certainly after then for many, many people, an identity as, let's use the term homosexual, which is the term that would have been used, was an individual identity as you said, the dominant identities that were available in the culture and that people would absorb as they grew up were, I'm a sinner, you know, I'm breaking the rules, the moral rules of the church, of the religious community in which I was born and in which my parents, you know, wanted to bring me up, or I'm a criminal, I'm breaking the laws, and in fact, I am vulnerable if I am caught to legal sanctions. You know, I can be fired, I can be evicted, I can be, I can be refused, service by any kind of, public accommodation. I mean, I'm basically an outlaw. And in the middle of the 20th century, in the period, you know, that we refer to, you know, generally as McCarthyism, the Cold War crackdown. Homosexuals were one of the prime targets, you know, the commie queer. It was viewed as a category of potential subversion. And medically, you know, the increasingly powerful definition was the scientific definition. This was the liberal one, that your problem was that you, it wasn't a moral issue of being a sinner. It wasn't, shouldn't be a legal issue of being a criminal. It should be a medical issue of being a patient, of being mentally ill, and therefore in need of the services of psychiatry to cure you. And the cures could be pretty drastic. They could range all the way to lobotomy, certainly a lot of electric shock and other kinds of, you know, and incarceration. So these three institutions, as you referred to, which are the dominant institutions in our society that define the parameters of the acceptable, what is acceptable versus sinful, what is acceptable versus illegal, what is acceptable versus abnormal or ill. What happens in the middle of the 20th century, and it happens in part because, curiously, because of the Kinsey report that says, you know, sex is not what it's supposed to be. There's a lot more going on than the official story we were taught in school or in church of, you know, chastity followed by monogamous marriage. Well, it turns out there was a lot less chastity and a lot more going on outside of marriage. And the most dramatic revelation in part of the Kinsey report was there was a lot more homosexual activity going on than the official story. And a few gay people began to say, a few, you know, homosexual people, gay people, men and women began to say, we're a minority group, and saying we should think of ourselves as an oppressed minority along the model of race and religion that were very salient terms in this period right after the Second World War. Racial issues were coming to the forefront in the U.S., and certainly religious discrimination, as in, you know, as in the Holocaust, was very much present. And gay people began to say, we need to think of ourselves as a community. At the same time, they were, in fact, literally becoming a community. And this is a very critical fact, because the population change in the United States right after the Second World War was unprecedented. It was in part the explosion of the suburbs with pent-up housing demand after the Depression and the Second World War, but it was also hundreds and thousands of young men who had been taken out of their communities to the army, or young women who had been taken out of their communities to work in defense industries. And many of them realized in these new surroundings that they could understand what they didn't understand about themselves in rural and small town communities they came from, which is their sexuality. And after the war, thousands, tens of thousands really, of these young men and women didn't go home. And they settled in urban areas, particularly along the coasts, California prominent among them, Los Angeles and particularly San Francisco, but also on the East Coast and elsewhere. And they began to literally create gay communities.
You're one of the pioneers of something called queer studies. And I never have understood this, because it sounds like an inherently pejorative.
Well, that's a linguistic reversal that gets used often by groups. What queer represented, I mean, it's now taken on a number of other meanings, but what it represented when people began using it in that way was the sense of being different.
Well, we're queer, we're here, get used to it.
Well, yes, we're not what we're supposed to be. We're different. And to some extent, it's the spirit of the 60s, although it was really the 80s.
But you're a pioneer of queer studies. Your books are...
Well, queer is partially a way of avoiding... Well, one thing, queer began being used in the 1980s in part to avoid the alphabet soup, LGBTQ, whatever. Well, you know,
that curses us today.
You know, and you know, these acronyms become increasingly awkward as, and queer was viewed by some people as a common characteristic attribute of all of these. Queer also began to be used, curiously enough, really in the 90s and beyond, by people who didn't necessarily identify as what we would say homosexual, but simply identified as not heteronormative. They didn't want to follow society's rules. And in that sense, it was like an echo of the 60s of people saying, look, we don't want to live according to the official conformist rules. We want to, you know, reinvent ourselves.
So let me just take you back to this history, because I think it's really important. I know younger gay people, I would put my own son, one of my sons in that category, feel that things have moved so fast that they wonder why in some ways we're dwelling on the past in that way. I know you have an answer, but let me just remind people who may not know this history. Yes, World War II brought about great population shifts. Yes, there was the development of beginning actual communities of gay people living together somewhat openly, but still oppressed by the police, certainly not accepted. And I just want to bring up some historical points. We're broadcasting this, taping this in Santa Monica. But in California, the laws didn't, it's not just, you know, some backwater areas. California, despite having gay communities, it wasn't until Willie Brown, as a member of the assembly, who kept pushing for change in the definition of sodomy and what is a crime and so forth, that came quite late, right? What year was that?
That was sometime in the 70s. But the reason for all of this is, and it is why it is important to understand history. I mean, I say this as a professor, so part of my job is historical memory so that we don't repeat things unnecessarily if we can help it. What was critical about the emergence of these communities was it began to produce, as it has for other minorities, ethnic and racial minorities, it began to produce political power. In the United States, minority political power has always come through urban concentrations. This was true for the Irish, it was true for the Poles, the Italians, it was true for Jews, and it was true for African Americans. They begin to get political power and begin to be able to move the system when they concentrate almost always in urban areas where you get that kind of concentration, what are sometimes called ghettos, but ghettos are also concentrations that are empowering. And if you have a concentration in an urban area, as the Irish did in Boston, or the Italians, or in New York or Chicago, the Poles.
Or Latinos in Los Angeles. Or
Latinos
now
in Los Angeles, or in Florida, other, you know, or in Texas. Urban concentrations translate into two things that politicians pay attention to. Votes and money. And urban politicians become the, first of all, sometimes they are members of the group, although for gay people that took longer than it did for the Irish or the Italians or the Poles. It took much longer to
When was Harvey Milk?
Harvey Milk was not the first openly gay elected official. The first one, actually, curiously enough, was in Minnesota. And then there was Elaine Noble in Massachusetts. But Harvey Milk was elected in San Francisco to as a member of the Board of Supervisors in 1977. And what it took, and this is very relevant, for Harvey Milk to be elected was San Francisco changed the system of electing the supervisors to a district-based system.
We should mention Harvey Milk, the subject of a very good film by Lance Black and others, was assassinated.
He was assassinated along with the mayor of San Francisco. But he was elected. He had run several times. He was successful in running when there was a district, and the district, the Castro district, was a heavily gay district. This is how political power comes about. It's through concentration in urban areas, translates into votes and money. So Willie Brown, a member of the state legislature from San Francisco, is responding to constituent pressure. That is, I mean, I'm sure he had nothing but the best intentions, was nothing but the most liberal instincts, but the actual political movement happens when you get the concentration that translates into votes and money. And politicians listen to votes and they listen to money. And what happened with gay people was they began to emerge in these urban areas, and they began through the 50s, but certainly into the 60s, to become more visible, to be less hidden. And one reason they were less hidden was, as they created communities, they had jobs they wouldn't be fired from. They had housing they wouldn't be evicted from. And the police, although they would routinely raid bars in order to make sure that they were getting their kickbacks, they would also, however, be more relaxed about oppression than they might be in a small town.
So let me say, this is Larry Gross that you're listening to. He's I would argue, he says I'm giving him too much credit, but I think he's been the leading scholar, and certainly in this country, on gay studies. He's the head of the International Communications Society. He was my boss at USC when he was the director. And I think one of his many books, but Up From Invisibility, I think was absolutely critical to framing this issue, because as long as gays were invisible, you could make any scapegoating, scurrilous charge. This is true of any group. If they're marginalized, they're ghettoized, they become the other, and you can say anything, and most people don't have evidence to counter that. What happened with gays in a way that was far more dramatic than any other marginalized, scorned group was visibility. And it came about in shows, you know, like Queer Folks and others and mass media. You could talk about that. But one thing that was very interesting, I remember after the Orlando massacre, you actually were telling me about the role of the bar in the gay community. And maybe we should mention that, because this was a safe zone. And I think one of the ways you could tell a gay bar is that there were not windows that you could look through.
Yeah. If you were in a town, you know, if you're looking for a gay bar, a good sign would be, a bar where, you know, the windows were dark or there were no windows so that nobody could see in. And that was always a good sign that this is likely to be a gay bar. There actually were guidebooks for gay people. There was a guy named Bob Damron who published a little booklet. Actually, by the end, the little booklet was, you know, about an inch or two thick for travelers. And it would tell, you know, town by town where the bars were, where other places were. It was a kind of secret guide for travelers to this hidden world. And interestingly enough, African Americans had similar guidebooks for traveling of places where you could go and be served, or places where you wouldn't get, you know, badly treated. So, and I'm sure Jews had the equivalent, you know, for people who navigated through potentially hostile territory.
Let me stop you there. You say you're sure Jews. Now, it's interesting because, of course, gay people have, all people have other identities. Mm-hmm. And in your case, I just have to throw this little footnote mm-hmm. in. Your father was a major intellectual who suffered under McCarthyism, right? Mm-hmm. And you actually ended up living in Israel mm-hmm. For what? Mostly your high school?
7 years.
You're fluent in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And I must say, because, you know, this whole thing, you have so many, as all human beings, different hats. Right. Mm-hmm. And one of them has been concerned about the rights of Palestinians and mm-hmm. and so forth. But I'm just interested in I remember I interviewed the guy who did the Tom Waddell. He did the gay Olympics.
Gay games. The Olympics took them to the Supreme Court to make sure they didn't use that word.
Yeah. And he was an Olympic athlete, mm-hmm. triathlon mm-hmm. athlete. And I remember I interviewed him and he was at Stanford. He was a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. And he got angry with me when I interviewed him. This was shortly before he died from AIDS. He was a great, great human being, researcher, medical researcher. And he got angry at me in that interview in a friendly way. He said, look, Bob, you keep talking about, yes, I did the gay games. Yes, I am gay. Yes, I did come out of the closet. You know, but the fact is, I have other things that I care about. I happen to be a socialist. You know, I happen to care a great deal about human rights. I happen to be very much concerned about civil rights for all people. I've been in that movement. And he just went through a whole list, you know, of his concerns and passions, and he kind of resented, even at that point, being put in the box of being gay.
That's probably a generational thing, but you know, I don't consider them all distinct, and I think certainly there is a thread that runs through my concerns, but not unusual in this, which is a concern, I suppose, for justice and for, you know, sort of equal treatment for all, and that certainly relates to to race and religion as much as it does to sexuality, or in the different ways. And yes, I grew up in my teens in Israel. This was a long time ago, and Israel was different. But even then, there were many aspects of it that disturbed me and that bothered me, in a very clear sense that the official story that was being taught in the schools that I was attending was a distorted story, and that much of it was simply not true.
You know, much of the homophobia is fueled by reference to the Old Testament.
Oh, yes. Well, the erotophobia of Judaism, which I have to say was heavily magnified by early Christianity. I mean, there were sex negative trends in the Old Testament, but nothing to the ones that were picked up and amplified thanks to St. Paul and St. Augustine, and were imposed on Western culture ever since then. The Bible was not actually what a lot of our fellow citizens think it is, you know, as in, for example, marriage, one man and one woman. Marriage in the Old Testament is polygamous. Abraham had a wife and a concubine. Jacob had four wives. Solomon, I believe, was up in the hundreds or thousands.
So something that's been assumed about the gay community is that somehow it's progressive. It will support liberal Democrats. Hillary Clinton, who is famous at spotting such trends to the point, in my view, of outrageous opportunism. After all, her husband did the DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, and now she's showing up at the gay Pride Parade.
Well, the Clintons have a history of going along with what they saw as politically expedient. One of Bill Clinton's first big political battles after he was elected was the military anti-gay policy, which he stumbled into inadvertently. He didn't intend it to be, but it happened. And that turned into his first big defeat at the hand of Congress and the Pentagon, who basically said they're going to show this draft dodger, you know, how the world works. And, you know, he surrendered. He blinked, and we ended up with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which merely increased anti-gay discrimination in the military until it was finally abolished. And then a few years later, when, again, unexpectedly, the Hawaiian Supreme Court ruled in favor of same-sex marriage, the same-sex marriage issue dropped into the political system. And again, the politicians made clear that this was a good issue, and Clinton, you know, sort of turned over, you know, rolled over and signed DOMA. He said, "I don't like it, but and he signed it." He went along, and you know, he just triangulated, I suppose you could say. Hillary Clinton was officially opposed to same-sex marriage until she wasn't. Same for Barack Obama, who famously evolved. The Democrats have a way of being careful and going along with what they view as expedient. And when the parade gets big enough, they decide they'll step in front.
One of the surprises, and you referred where the really horrible period of McCarthyism in that period in terms of repression of any variety in life of any kind. But one of the main culprits in that, the right-hand guy for Senator McCarthy, was Roy Cohn. You know, and here they were, you know, going after people like Bayard Rustin, who famously organized the Civil Rights March on Washington, who was one of the first openly gay individuals who was prominent in this country, and yet was, you know, he didn't want that to be his biggest issue. He, as a black man, he felt civil rights on a racial basis was critical at that point. But they went after him. The FBI went after him. They went after other gay people in the people. But it's interesting. There was Roy Cohn, who was the hatchet man for McCarthy, who was gay and later in life became quite open. A guy named, I just want to mention one other, Bob Bauman.
Roy Cohn never became open. Roy Cohn went to his death from AIDS denying that he was homosexual. Roy Cohn was the dictionary definition of what you would call a self-hating gay person, just as the term, you know, self-hating Jew or others are used. But Roy Cohn really was. He never admitted that he was gay. He was never public about it. Okay. He was, in fact, homosexual. He did die of AIDS. But he was a complete scum sleaze to the end. Okay, and so he was, incidentally, one of Donald Trump's mentors, as has been recently written about. But no, gay people were victimized by the left and the right. The Communist Party was very hostile to homosexuals who were not allowed to be open or were expelled.
It was a crime in communist countries.
Some of them. Actually, it was abolished as a crime in the Soviet Union, but then it was brought back again.
Cuba, you had,
yes, Cuba had a very bad record.
Castro had his UMAP camps.
Very bad record.
Even in the 60s, he was rounding up homosexuals in Havana.
Absolutely. They had a very
re-education
bad, very
camps.
Bad record on that. No, right. A lot of our, a lot of political exports turn out to be regressive on this. I mean, the worst places now in terms of public policy on homosexuality are many African countries where Western evangelical religion that is failing to get its way in terms of homosexuality in the United States is exporting its crusade to Africa, places like Uganda, where they're trying to make it a capital crime. But, you know, homosexuals, to answer your earlier point, are not and never have been a coherent community. They are dispersed throughout, as you said earlier, they're dispersed throughout society. They're in every class, every ethnic group, everywhere. They are, as the phrase went, everywhere.
Because once invisibility ended and people came out, oh, yeah, it's my cousin, it's my minister, it's this person, that person, we had great progress. There's now a tendency to think it's over as an issue. And Orlando was a very, you know, frightening reminder that it's not over as an issue. It persists as a very important issue. There are political forces in our country that want to use it as a divisive issue. Certainly the moral majority was one such thing. And so what is your feeling about where we are now? Is Orlando the kind of shock that gets us to examine our prejudices and the way we
briefly
treat people?
Briefly. I mean, I think there has been enormous change. There'll continue to be change because this is the kind of change which, you know, it's like a snowball rolling downhill. It picks up weight and speed simply because of its pervasiveness. I think the media, as, you know, you said earlier, has played an enormous role because it begins to let people know that this is a possibility, that this is part of life, and that they're not unique and different. What happens through the media now that didn't happen in the past is that young people growing up and realizing that they're not what they were expected to be have images, have models, have opportunities to think about themselves differently, to connect, to make connections. The media and the internet, very importantly, have broken through invisibility and isolation, which were the two oppressive conditions for growing up gay through, you know, much of history until very recently. Because even though we use this term community, the fact is that unlike African Americans or Jews or other groups, people are not born into gay communities. People are born into heterosexual families and heterosexual communities, and then at some point, earlier and earlier, you know, these days, realize they're not what they were told they were or expected to be, and that they're different. But they now have ways of thinking about that difference that are not as oppressive and not as frightening and not as damaging as they were in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and even the 80s.
So let me end by asking you, as your media expertise, yes, at the end of the day, you know, Hollywood, mass media, and so forth, they arrive. You know, we learn about the Holocaust. We learn about the blacklist against, you know, people who are called communists. We have programs that actually help have a breakthrough on the gay issue, showing gay people in reality, television, and so forth. But despite, and it hit me when I was covering this issue, you know, until Rock Hudson died, because, you know, Ronald Reagan knew plenty of gay people in the industry, but the industry did not cover the issue. The industry did not cover segregation, racial segregation. It did not cover the Holocaust. So as an expert on media, maybe this is a good point because we're doing here alternative media. How does this communications industry go through centuries of ignoring the obvious?
They were afraid of the audience. They were afraid of the audience and they were afraid of advertisers. And they were afraid that the advertiser, that the audience would be alienated and that advertisers or pressure groups like the League for Decency and, you know, and other groups that were trying to pressure the industry.
But they betrayed themselves.
Yes, they did betray themselves. They were afraid of the audience. There's a line I use in my book about outing, the contested closets. I talk there about Hollywood's, you know, closeted religion, you know, all the Jews who pretended they weren't Jewish. And at one point, there's a story I tell about an actor from New York named Julius Garfinkel, who was on Broadway. And when he was brought out to Hollywood, he had to change his name. And he changed his name to John Garfield. And Warner, Harry Warner, says, "Garfield, that sounds Jewish." And, you know, the actor said, "Well, there was a President Garfield." And Warner said, "Oh, I guess that's okay, but it still sounds Jewish." And the actor said, "But we are, you know, I am Jewish." And Warner said, "So are we, but they don't know it." There was a fear in Hollywood that if the public saw the degree to which the industry was not normal American, Midwestern WASPy, they would be upset or offended. So pretty much every actor that became a success in Hollywood during the 30s and 40s through the 50s changed their name. Often they had to get a nose job. And actually, one of the first people who broke that pattern was Barbara Streisand, who refused to change her name and refused to get a nose job and got away with it. And this history of this
is that when people succeed
despite that, that stiffens the backbone of the executives to think, well, maybe you can do that. Another one was Dustin Hoffman. I mean, there were examples of people who didn't look right or sound right or have the right name who got away with it, who still succeeded. It's the, if you like, the Jackie Robinson moment.
So what about gays in
Hollywood? We're beginning to have that. Gays are,
what about that during that terrible AIDS crisis?
They all had to pretend to be straight. They all had to, you know, they all had to get married, or, you know, they had fake marriages and their fake romances, and the gossip columnists would all cooperate and they would all, you know, talk about their romances. I mean, if you remember, one of the first examples of the outing thing was Malcolm Forbes, pre-Donald Trump, proud capitalist public figure who had a famous off-and-on romance with Elizabeth Taylor. And, you know, they used to go around together and the media would write, you know, well, you know, when is Malcolm Forbes going to marry Elizabeth Taylor? You know, she was just his beard, as they said, his disguise. And when Malcolm Forbes died and the gay paper in New York wrote about him being homosexual, there was a big scandal. And that's, in fact, when the term outing was invented to describe the act of revealing the hidden homosexuality of public figures. And, you know, this began to change the rules, and the media began to become a little more honest about covering people whom they knew were gay, you know, but they didn't want to talk about it. And they began to move away from the notion that talking about it was somehow, you know, disgraceful, or, you know, that it was a stigma. And people began saying, no, if it's not a stigma, then why do you act as if it is? So that began to change, and people began to be more public about being gay in the media, in politics. Barney Frank eventually came out, and others as well. And, you know, and after that, there were even examples, Tammy Baldwin being one in the Senate, who was elected to the Senate as a lesbian, you know, not coming out afterwards. So this is beginning to change, and it takes time. And when it happens and the earth doesn't open up and swallow them, then they're a little more courageous next time.
Well, that's it for Sheer Intelligence. Larry Gross, a leading academic, author of very important books, including Up From Invisibility, the role of persecution and of gays in American life, and the role of the media and exploring it or apologizing for it. I want to thank you for being my guest today.
Sure.
The producers of Sheer Intelligence are Josh Sheer and Rebecca Mooney. Our engineers at KCRW are Kate Yore and Mario Diaz. I'm Robert Sheer. Thanks for listening. Sakam